All right. Thank you again and welcome. Thank you for coming. Thank you for being with us this morning. It'll be very interesting to hear what you have to say this morning. It always is, but it's especially pertinent this morning because this is an open forum on Jnana Yoga. We'll start, however, with some announcements. First of all, yesterday was Seva Saturday for this month, and it was a remarkable day. A large number of people turned out, and we got a lot done. We got a lot done. So thank you to all who came, and I repeat my invitation to all of you who aren't coming on Seva Saturdays. You will find it a joyous experience, so come and see if you can't spend an hour or two with us on that Saturday. Join us for lunch if you like. Yesterday, again, we had delicious pizza from Mellow Mushroom. So it's a good time to be with the rest of the devotees and help serve your center in a very meaningful way. When I say a lot got done yesterday, I mean a lot got done. It was wonderful. So thank you. As far as other announcements go, next week we will talk about Swami Vivekananda's Jnana Yoga. Last week we talked about about Adi Shankaracharya's Jnana Yoga, Advaita Vedanta. This week we're having an open forum so that we can do some manana together, we can do some digestion together of what we're learning about Jnana Yoga. And then next week we'll get some specifics from Swami Vivekananda, some pointers about how to proceed if Jnana Yoga or Advaita Vedanta is indeed your path. The following Sunday, the 27th, we will celebrate Swami Vivekananda's birthday. Now, his Gregorian calendar birthday was actually yesterday. January 12th, 1863 was when he was born. But the lunar calendar, as you know, is somewhat different. It moves around. And so we will celebrate his lunar calendar birthday on Sunday the 27th with a puja. I'll serve as your pujari for that puja that day. And it will be a joyous occasion as always, starting with the shrine decoration at 10 a.m., puja starts at 11, and then there'll be a short talk about Swami Vivekananda and why it's so joyous for us to celebrate his birthday. Then the worship itself, the puja itself, and then, as always, we go into the monastery for a prasad potluck lunch. Any of you who are bringing food to share with the Lord on that day, please be sure it's here by 11 a.m. so that the people who are responsible in the kitchen can get it nicely prepared to offer. As we get closer to February, we'll talk about February. But right now, we're going to start with our... Unless anyone has... Yes, Lori.
You want to mention about people maybe helping out?
Ah, yes, thank you. There's always need for people to help, starting at about 9 a.m. on the day of any puja. So if you feel like coming and being of service on that day, there's lots to do to get ready for shrine decoration and then the puja itself. And I'd like to just again thank those people who came yesterday for Seva Saturday, and I'd like to thank those people who have been helpful in the past with pujas. So, thank you, Lori.
But also maybe in the kitchen and preparing.
Yes, helping in the kitchen, helping in the kitchen on Sundays, and we go in after we finish here. We have a table spread with good things to eat, and some tea and coffee and so on. And then on the day of the puja, there is the need for people in the kitchen getting the food ready, and they can get it ready so that they can come in and participate in the puja. You know, they can come in at 11 a.m. Or shortly after 11 a.m. and participate in the puja. That's thank you, Lori. That's excellent. Okay. Anything else that this old mind didn't think to mention? All right. We open with our opening chant, which is a recollection of our relationship to the divine being and our purpose here this morning. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahano Bhunaktu, Sahaviryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavaditamastu, Mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. May the Divine Being look over us lovingly as a mother and father. May the Divine Being support and nourish us as a mother and father. May we have the strength and skill to study together the art of spirituality. May no misunderstandings arise amongst us. Om, peace, peace, peace be unto us and to all beings everywhere. And as always, I like to note that that wonderful translation of that ancient prayer was by the founder of this place, Swami Yogeshananda. He'll celebrate his 95th birthday early in February. So he's living at the Trubuco Monastery in Southern California. So today, as I mentioned earlier, is an open forum on Jnana Yoga or Advaita Vedanta. And I have some readings because not everyone is as familiar with this as they will be as time goes on. So I'm going to do some readings put this in profile, and then after our discussion, I'll have a final reading. The first reading is from Sri Ramakrishna, and it's very simple, and it puts the whole thing of why we're here this morning and why we study these things. Sri Ramakrishna said, "Find God, that is the only purpose in life." So as those of you who have been coming regularly, each month we take up the study of one of the four yogas. January is this month for the study of Jnana Yoga, Advaita Vedanta. As a Jnana Yogi, you practice discrimination, reason, detachment, and satyagraha, insistence on truth. The goal is freedom from limitation, mukti. Our teachers say that all miseries in life are caused by seeing inaccurately. An earnest and persistent jnani may break through this lifelong experience of misapprehension, called maya, and see only the divine presence everywhere, in everything and everyone. That is the goal of all of the yogas, but it is especially relevant to jnana or advaita. As we know, we come from a tradition called Vedanta. This is how Swami Vivekananda taught it when he came to the West. He said, "I have a mission to the West as Buddha had a mission to the East. I have a mission to the West as Buddha had a mission to the East." And he called that mission in the West the teaching of Vedanta. Vedanta, of course, means the end or the aim or the purpose of the Vedas. The end of each Veda is an Upanishad, which means sitting near your teacher. It has other meanings, but that's the most relevant for us. Upanishad, sitting near your teacher. Among these Upanishads, there were four particularly potent sayings or aphorisms, four Mahavakyas, Over thousands of years, mystics affirmed this, that there is a divine presence everywhere and everything and everyone. Over thousands of years, mystics affirmed this. In the Upanishads, these are four aphorisms called Mahavakyas, great statements of truth. Each points to the underlying reality of existence called Brahman. The first one is Prajnanam Brahma. Translation into English, consciousness is Brahman. Second, Aham Brahmasmi. One of the rishis simply said it that way. Aham Brahmasmi. I am Brahman. Another, pointing to his students or her students, said, Tattvamasi, that thou art. So as looking out here this morning from this seat, this is what the attempt is to see, that each of you is the divine presence. Tattvamasi. How affectionate is that statement? That thou art. And then the final, Ayam Atma Brahma. This self is indeed Brahman. This self, this Brahman with attributes called the Atman, Saguna Brahman, Brahman with attributes, or the gunas. This self is Brahman. Now, to put this into perspective for us, Swami Vivekananda was very succinct. He said, pointing, without saying it in so many words, pointing toward that tattvamasi, each soul is potentially divine. Potentially means like there's electricity in a battery. We don't know it until we use the battery. We, as Sri Krishna points out in the Gita, we don't know ourselves as Brahman until we enter the field of action as human beings, this being the field of action. Each soul is potentially divine. The goal is to manifest this divinity within, by controlling nature, external and internal. Do this either by work or worship or psychic control or philosophy, by one or more or all of these, and be free. The goal is freedom. By controlling external nature, Swamiji did not mean cutting down trees. He meant you're controlling your relationship with the external world, with the world that seems to be outside of yourself, as well as controlling the internal self. Having made these three points, Swamiji said, this is the whole of religion. This is the whole of religion. Doctrines or dogmas or rituals or books or temples or forms are but secondary details. Each soul is potentially divine. Then he says, find that divinity, manifest that divinity, by one of these four methods, work, karma yoga, worship, bhakti yoga, psychic control, raja yoga, or philosophy, advaita or jnana yoga. He said, all of the rest of what appears to be religion is but secondary details. Two basic principles of the path of philosophy, jnana yoga, are viveka, discrimination between the unreal or the less real, the relative reality in which we live, discrimination between that and the reality that is behind it. So that's viveka. Discrimination between the unreal or less real and the real. Vivekananda said, we do not move from error to truth. We move from lower truth, if you will, to higher truth. From lower truth to higher truth. We do that through this process of discrimination. And once we are clear about there being a higher truth, we practice vairagya, the release of worldly desires and attachments. This is the control of nature external, so that it doesn't control us, we control it. As Adi Shankaracharya pointed out and was talked about last week, with sustained attention and devotion to your goal over years of practice, discrimination and release will certainly lead you forward in spiritual life, and at last to realization and life as a jivan mukta, one who has been liberated while still embodied. Jivan, the individual human being, mukta, free, liberated, free of limitation. What does sustained attention over years mean? It's easy for us to talk about these things. It's easy for us to simply have a good intellectual grasp of them. But the process is more profound than that. The three steps, according to both Vasishta, the great teacher of Advaita Vedanta, who was the counselor and teacher of the incarnation Rama, and of Adi Shankaracharya, these are the steps. Shravana, first hearing or reading, hearing the truths. Then manana. Shravana, then manana. And what we're going to be doing here this morning as a group is manana. We think over these things and then talk them over, whether we talk them over with ourselves or we talk them out among ourselves here, like in a group like this. We take it into our mind and we compare the way we have been living with the truths that we have been given about what will lead us forward. Once we are convinced of the truths, the higher truths being the more powerful truths, the ones that should control the nature of the way we live, then we practice nididhyasana, which is constant reflection on and recollection of and insistence on those truths, thereby controlling nature external and internal. So those are the three steps for the jnani: shravana, manana, nididhyasana. As I said, there's a reading that I'll give at the end, but that's sufficient, I think, for us to start our open forum, our discussion. Yes, Sean.
We are told that we are limitless. I mean, am brahmasmi, basically you are limitless. Mm-hmm. But the way my body is, I'm very limited.
Yes.
All my faculties and everything is very limited.
Mm-hmm.
So how do I see the unlimited with limited source resources?
Swami Vivekananda said it is already fully manifest within you, that all of this seeming limitation is simply coverings of the truth. So through this process of manana, we think, I have been told this is the truth. I am unlimited. And yet I'm living as a limited being. What do I need to do to release myself from the illusion of this limitation? And the books, particularly Adi Shankaracharya's Viveka Chudamani, has a step-by-step process for this. You, first of all, you begin to think of the body very differently. You begin to think of the body as not just your vehicle, but as an actual impediment. The things of the body are impediments. And so as you focus on that, and he's very explicit about what are the nature of these impediments, then we disidentify ourselves with the body. We say, this is my enemy as well as my friend. My mind and the rest of my body, the rest of the mind stuff, the citta, which is throughout the body, is not just my friend to enable me to cope with the world and cope with my life. It is also my enemy. It is the nature, it is the very nature of the limitation. So we practice the steps, and we're doing it this morning. We're talking about what it is that will free us from these limited ideas, this misapprehension. Swami Vivekananda's lectures on Maya, the nature of Maya and how it affects us, are published in that book, Jnana Yoga. We're studying that on Wednesday evenings. It is a very, very good education in the nature of limitation and its illusory quality. It's what he refers to in a number of places very powerfully as the dreamlike experience of life, life as a dream. He says, no one can prove to me this is not a dream. And so he requests that we wake up from the dream of limited life as we wake up from the dreams that we dream in the night when we're asleep. Very good question, Chum. Anybody else?
You can't say me over here.
I cannot, no, but thank you for speaking up.
What I'm really curious about is people's actual experience of, I don't know who in here is practicing Jnana Yoga and who isn't, but for people that are that feel like that's part of their spiritual path and their practice, what is your actual experience? And I'll share mine in a second. But sometimes I've read a lot of books and I know a lot of theory, but I want to know what people are actually doing and how it's changed your life and how it's been difficult and so on. And for me, I'm not sure if I'm within the Vedanta framework of the four yogas. I'm not really sure if what I'm doing is Jnana Yoga or not. It talks about being about philosophy, which is about words and language. Mm-hmm. And then it talks about Advaita, which is seeing how things are undivided. In my experience, I do occasionally have glimpses of the undivided nature of things in meditation or periods of freedom in meditation. But that's not in language. It's outside of language, mm-hmm. words, and philosophy. So I enjoy language, words, and philosophy, but I don't think that that's really part of my spiritual practice. Or maybe sometimes I use language to free myself from language. You know, like saying, this isn't true, this isn't really reality, and it frees me from it. In meditation, when my mind quiets down, sometimes, like I say, I have the experience that can't really be put into words, but Advaita, undivided, is a good attempt to put it into words. Mm-hmm. But like I say, I've read a lot of books. I know a lot of theory. I wouldn't have to come here to learn books and theory. I came here to connect with the people in the room and hear about what you're actually doing and your real experience.
Good. Is anyone willing to share what they're doing? Yes, please jump.
I read Ramana Maharshi said, reading books will not give you realization.
No.
That's what he said, that these books. You may read books, but that will not give you any God realization. So, I mean, it helps, but definitely is not going to lead you to. So, I don't know what. Probably you need more meditation or something like that.
Well, the is anyone else got anything they'd like to share? Yes, first here, and then a couple of people over here.
I think it is like the little steps that you take every day, every moment, that helps you progress. For example, I was kind of having a hard time, and I still am. How do you become dispassionate when you're leading a worldly life? If you look at Google and the meaning of dispassion, I think one of the synonyms is cold or cold-hearted, mm-hmm. whereas the whole spiritual process is to make you joyful.
Mm-hmm.
So the way I'm sort of trying to reconcile that is, if I'm in a situation where I'm finding joy, like for instance this morning, or mm-hmm. listening to devotional music, or try to take that as a gift from God and be joyful and not say, no, I'm not supposed to be attached. And vice versa, if there is a, when I leave the class and, you know, things happen and the joy recedes, then take that also as a gift from God and try to say, okay, you know, try to see both. I mean, that's what I'm trying to do, and not necessarily become cold-hearted in the sense that, no, I don't want to be joyful, or I don't want to be, you know, unhappy. Or
the great gyanis have been anything but cold-hearted, haven't they? You mentioned the name Ramana Maharshi. Sham mentioned Ramana Maharshi. He was anything but cold-hearted. Nisargadatta Maharaj, anything but cold-hearted. Gave and gave and gave of himself. No, it's not a question of cold-heartedness. It's a question of being decisive about what serves you and what does not. And that may seem sometimes, as you are self-determined in this way, it may seem sometimes to others that you're being selfish. Oh, you no longer share the things with me that you used to share with me. You're being selfish with yourself. You're simply being self-determined, saying, this does not serve me. You're not turning your heart in a cold way toward those persons. You're just saying, this is no longer a useful way to spend my time. That's discrimination and release. And those are action words. Discrimination is not an intellectual process. It's an actual seeing. This is not serving me. And then release is opening your hands and saying, I let this go. So it's not cold-hearted, though it may seem sometimes to others as if you're being indifferent toward them. You're just simply deciding what are their real needs and what are their sentimental or superficial needs. In the back.
So I think your answer, like, because we were talking about Bhagavad Pad Shankara, so in his Brahma Sutra Bhashyas, again, I'm using text to answer your answer about text. So he, in fact, says in the very beginning that the first sutra is Athato Brahma Jigyasa, that is, thus begins the inquiry into the nature of the Brahman. And he says that even to get at that inquiry, you need certain qualities, which is of control and other things, which we have been talking about. So while he writes very what seems to be very philosophic, and he's talking to these Purva Mimamsakas, the other school of Indian philosophy who came before him, who had a lot of focus on language and used language in a particular manner, he completely changes that. He uses language quite differently and makes it the aid through which you can come to that realization. And therefore, I think it's to be seen as a reflective process, as Brother Shankara said, like manana. So manana is also contemplation, reflection. So shastras help us to see if we are where are we going, rather than really bringing us to some kind of realization. And I think what Bhagavatpada Shankara is doing through his texts is that through those sutras which he comments on, he uses them as probably mantras, because reading them also brings some kind of that repetition brings in realization sometimes.
Thank you. The thing I'd really be curious about is like how you use that and how it affected your life. That's my interest, is like who's doing what. What works, what doesn't work, what problems are there, things like that.
I think it does work for me, so yeah.
It's working for you.
Hang on just a minute, Jim. There was somebody else over here. Yes.
In response to the older gentleman over that side, I was thinking, he said reading doesn't really do anything, but that is how we learned everything, through reading.
Yes, that's
by implementing.
That's the shravana. It's absolutely, yeah.
Right. Implementing and testing what we read, whether it really works in the real life,
yes,
or not, isn't it?
Yes. Well, first we have to learn it by either hearing it from a teacher or reading it. We have to learn that there are some truths other than the ones that we are practicing in our lives. Most people never think about it very much, but they come from a very solid structure of belief about who they are and what the world is, and that's how they're making decisions and going forward. A lot of it is very automatic with most people. It's unquestioned. And so the first answer to Tom's question is we begin to question ourselves. As Dr. Phil says on those shows, how's that working for you? Well, when we see that something we're doing goes on and on, but it's not working for us, well, then we learn something new. Oh, well, maybe this will work for me. And then we do it. It's not a matter of thinking about it. It's a matter of doing it. There was another hand further back, and then Jim. I think it was you in the corner, wasn't it? No? Did I miss-see? Okay, Jim. Okay, go ahead.
I mean, like you say, how is it working for you? But it's in this room, you literally throb with the feeling, the ambience and everything, like a passionate feeling of connection and all, what are people doing? And then all of us are doing this collective divinity search, and it thrives. But when you get out in the world again, I totally get lost. But anyway, I know now, while keeping on coming and doing it and...
Yes.
Balancing the real world with the, we know all, that's what text is. It's so profound when you're sitting in a quiet room, when it's, Mahafaleshu Kadachana, and all these things, it sinks with you and it resonates.
Yes.
But when you're thrown in the world, it's like I'm totally like in a whirlwind. So anyway, we're finding our way, and this really helps coming here. But going back to the other question you said about the physical body, you think of it as an enemy versus a friend. That another thing is, I still totally think I was not valuing my body and not respecting it, having some reverence for it. And I was trying to say, okay, I'm going to be more watchful of how much magic is happening in this beautiful body. So now you give me a different way of looking at it, as think of it as an impediment, which is what I tend to think. I'm trying to make myself think of it as a magical possibility.
We have to have both, don't we? We have to have both. We have to have appreciation and a sense of wonder for this self-repairing, self-replicating machine. On the other hand, we have to see that it is a limitation for what, if we're going to believe what we're told, what we read, is an unlimited presence within it. So this is why it's called a razor's edge. This is why it's called walking a razor's edge.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter if we fall off the razor's edge. It's not a very big fall off the razor's edge. But the thing for us to do is right away get back on. I'll get to you, Paul. Jim?
Yes, sir. And going back to Tom's question, for me, you know, he was wondering how it worked for different people and what they did. For me, I would just say consistency has worked for me, consistency in reading. And the thing that really hit me years ago was the Jnani Yoga.
Mm-hmm.
And that just really hit me. And that's, you know, I began to read books that pertained to that, as well as others, but that really was the books for me.
Okay, and I think, Jim, though, his question is, what do you do in your life besides reading? The reading is a given, yeah, we got that. What do you do besides that to make what you read work for you?
Yeah, the reading is important, but it's the consistency of it at the same time every day, consistency, and then just underlining things that hit me and just rewording it, just kind of trying to get the meaning, the thought.
So that is manana. You just described manana.
Yes,
the underlining, the thinking, the putting it into your own words. That's manana.
I might only read just a page or two. And I'll just underline, maybe write things down, but I'll reword it and just try to see what is this saying here.
And now the rest of his question was, how has this affected your life? How has it changed your life? And each of you now, if you can address yourself more directly to Tom's question, that would be good. You know, what have you learned? What do you do as a result of what you've learned? And how has that affected your life? If you care to voice it.
Yeah, I would say I'm still learning a great bit, but the main thing is just not allowing things to affect me as much, not just seeing through.
When you say not affect you, what would be the effect that you're not allowing
just
to emerge?
Being aroused up or stirred up, uh-huh. Just not being. I mean, I still have,
not allowing the mind to be disturbed
as much.
As much, yeah. Well said. It's one thing to live out on your bee farm, but it's another to come to Atlanta, indeed, yes.
But just not being, just seeing through things and realizing that they're just,
yes.
they come and go.
That I'm misapprehending them. It's when I let them affect me, I am seeing them incorrectly, inaccurately.
Just identifying yourself without, not being identified with body and mind.
Yes.
And just seeing who you really truly are.
And that is the control of nature, external and internal. You just said it in your own words. Not the body, not the mind. Controlling those two and having a proper perspective. Paul?
That question about the direct impact on our behavior, our experience. You said something this morning, Ambrosia Shankara, that God realization is our highest goal or our number one priority.
That's what Sri Ramakrishna said.
Yeah,
you
said something to that. When I hear that, I find it helpful. I guess for me, it just sort of allows me to release a lot of other things that get into my agenda.
What do you mean release?
Letting, sensing, sensing my body and just letting go of the stories, letting go of the narrative, something, even feeling my hands on my thighs, and something I just kind of picked up is I noticed when I put my hands, my palms down on my thighs, I breathe more from my belly.
Mm-hmm.
And when I just, if I make that setup, putting the back of my hands on my thighs, the breath shifts up to my up to my mid chest.
Mm-hmm.
And it's out of the narrative. It's out of the, I think it's a very tricky thing. The verbalizing the, the paradoxes of spiritual practice. But, one question I sometimes ask is just, what would it look like?
Mm-hmm.
If I actually were, making God realization my highest priority in life today, what would that look like?
That's manana. Yes, indeed.
There's some discernment there.
Yes.
There's things that I probably won't be doing so much of, and there's things I'm likely, and even how I do the things that I do.
Well, you've said some very, very important things as you went along in this, Paul. Thank you. One of the things you said was being attentive. Being attentive to even something like what happens when I put my hands flat down on my thighs and when I put them up. In other words, there is something very interactive about this machine, and it has implications. And letting go of those things that are no longer serving what becomes your priority. What would it look like? Okay, it would look more like this. This is what I read. This is what I think. So it would look more like this. So I can see that it doesn't include these things. So I have to let them go. It just doesn't include them anymore. This is the process of manana. And then when you are fully convinced that I have got a good picture of what the priority looks like, what the life looks like under that priority, then you insist on it day after day after day. Somebody else brought that up. Jim, consistency. Bringing it, returning day after day after day. Not letting it slip away into the morass of everydayness. Which, of course, is the world will do that to us. Very, very good. Somebody else? Yes, please. Michelle.
I agree with what you say, that for me, since I started this new journey, it's about the narrative and how my thinking makes me suffer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe in this Maya illusion about, desire, mm-hmm. worldly desires and things, right? That's one thing that I've been practicing, letting go of those things. But I think the most important one for me is coming to know now that myself is just, like God. It changed the position that I'm in life now, like where I come from, when I interact with others.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when they create negative feelings for whatever reason, they rough mm-hmm. my feathers.
Mm-hmm.
I can no longer react like I used to, because mm-hmm. I gotta see the God in them too. So it changes how, everything. Because, we live in a world that, like people in traffic or whatever, they rough your feathers.
Mm-hmm.
For lack of better words.
No, that's a very good way to
put it. I'd be reactive, but then I realize, wait a minute. This is not right. This is an illusion, And then I have to look at not only that they're God themselves, but that they're also under the spell of Maya. And that they, wherever they are on their journey, that's where they are. They haven't realized some stuff, maybe, and, that's their play. That's their character. I call it the character. So this is what the character, this is where they are in their journey, and I don't try to change it. But, it gives me, I would say, more compassion. The place that I come from is from a more compassionate way. And I'm not always successful. I have moments that I'm like, but then I catch myself. I'm like, well, maybe that wasn't the right way to react to that.
So beautifully said, Michelle. Notice this theme of recollection. Recollection. Constantly reminding ourselves. And Paul said something that I didn't take a sufficient note of when he was speaking. And that is letting go of the old narrative. We have this way of telling ourselves who we are and what the world is. It's our narratives. And we repeat it. We find ourselves doing it as we're thinking.
Mm-hmm. Some of the things that I did in the past too, if I was to stay where I was, I would be very regretful and carry them heavily. But now that I know that I'm on this side, it's like I have to practice some forgiveness and compassion, because it's like I didn't know better.
Forgiveness for yourself and for others who do similar things to the things that...
That's why I want to do it too. It's like, a lot of knowledge. I mean, I can go that route, but if I don't know what what it means and how to put it out and practice it, it's just knowledge. But you take a few concepts, just the basic ones, like, I am that, and roll with that one and practice it on everything that you do, and you don't need to know much more. I mean, this, Hinduism apparently has a lot of books and names and this and that.
Well, sure.
I'm like, wait a minute, let's take the basics and, I am that.
Well, if I remember correctly, Tom, I can recall, this is now some years ago, you beginning to talk about the practice of kindness, that you'd made a decision, a determination, almost a vow, to just practice kindness, and what's the effect of that? The effect of that is to soothe the other person, which, of course, lowers your own blood pressure as well as theirs. So your mind is less ruffled when you're practicing kindness. It's something that the Dalai Lama talks about constantly. Come from the heart. Come from kindness and compassion. He said, my religion is having a good heart, he says. And this isn't, notice it's all about action. It's not about thinking about it. It's about doing. Practicing kindness. Practicing compassion. Yeah. Anybody else? Yes, Swayam.
I liked how you put a lot of these things that we are doing, practicing compassion, seeing the divinity in others, it's all controlling the external without cutting down the trees.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the classes you say to harmonize yourself with the outside world. And mm-hmm. that harmony then helps to calm down and harmonize the inside.
Yes.
So then you're able to give more effort to the meditative process of reaching beyond the boundary.
Yes, and it reinforces itself. The more you do that, the more powerful it becomes. And the more you see the results, the more affirmed you are and the more resolved you are to continue.
So
beautifully
said. That was so beautifully said, that we do the kindness to others not for them, but for ourselves. When you are kind to others, when you help others, you have more faith that, it feels good. That's a wonderful thing.
Well, that's what Vivekananda says. Remember, the opportunity to serve others is to benefit you. It's not to benefit them. Of course it benefits them. But that's not the point. It's to decrease your selfishness. Your decrease of selfishness decreases your mental agitation. If you're not constantly seeing the world in terms of I, me, mine, how is this going to affect me? But in terms of how is this going to affect the other person? If you can, three times it's been mentioned the idea of the traffic and, what it's like here in Atlanta. If you can, in traffic, simply think, boy, that person is having a bad day or even a bad life. They're sharing their misery in the only way they know how. And so what you're doing then is offering them the opportunity not to share it with you. Say, okay, take that car length. You know, you were a little dangerous in what you did. Nothing bad happened, thank God. But no reason for me to get excited. There's that beautiful Bob Dylan song, All Along the Watchtower. No reason to get excited, said the Joker to the thief. So the more we practice not getting excited, the more clearly we see. The more clearly we see, the easier it is to practice not being excited. Yes, Paul.
You know, there's a famous quote from Che Guevara. Mm-hmm. You may have heard it.
Heard of Che Guevara.
Yeah, that if you are enraged at the injustice in the world, or the least injustice in the world, then you are my brother and comrade. I just kind of wonder about the. It seems like that's a rather revolutionary, South American revolutionary,
mm-hmm.
and that there. I guess how to balance that out. Whether it's when you watch the news for 15 minutes,
mm-hmm.
and it's just one thing after another, and I'm usually pretty apathetic. Quite frankly, it doesn't really affect me very much because I feel like there's nothing I can do about most of it. But, and things like when something smaller, like if someone cuts in front of you in line,
mm-hmm.
you know, when they're kind of treating you disrespectfully,
mm-hmm.
you know, that, you know, when to be assertive and when to just let it go and be... passively at peace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is there some discernment sometimes about when do I say, when do I disturb the universe or the other person or even allow myself to be disturbed? And, you know, it seems like sometimes this seems like we're letting go, we're becoming wet noodles
mm-hmm.
in this practice. And I don't know, I think you understand my question.
Oh, I do. And I'd like to hear how the rest of you react to what Paul said. What happens when you listen to the news or watch the news and something hits you as a great injustice? Or how do you react? What happens? Please, I think this goes right to Tom Carr's question as well. How are we living our lives and what difference does it make to us? So anybody want to talk about what happens when they... Yes?
I want to say something about that.
Yes.
Yes, when you listen to something in the news, it is what it is. I question myself, do I have any control over this?
Mm-hmm.
Do I don't have control over this? If I have control over this, I only have control over my thoughts, how I process in my brain.
Mm-hmm.
So I could just say, well, it is what it is. That's what is happening. There's nothing I can do about it. If I can do something about it, then I should do it. If I can do anything about it, let it go. Let God. That's my philosophy of life. So that just kind of, it doesn't give you blood pressure or it doesn't raise your blood pressure either, both ways. And then something Paul said, like somebody cuts you, let's say on the road when you're driving, somebody cuts you, and you can think of it. You can go on a road rage, but that will increase your blood pressure. It's not going to benefit you. And you could make an accident and kill yourself or other people or hurt other people. Or you could just say, well, probably that guy has or girl had a bad day today.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they're just not themselves on the road. So let me be careful.
Mm-hmm.
Why not I watch all four sides? Let me be careful. So I know he's going to be in trouble, but I can't control him or her.
Excellent. If you're living that, will profit you
that's
immensely.
Exactly.
Anybody else?
This is what we're... Kick in.
Say it again.
unless the vasanas kick in.
Oh yes, well they will. They always will. They always will. When that guna of the other person being disrespectful or dangerous or cutting in front of you in line or something, this is the gunas blowing their wind across your samskaras, all of those mental impressions in your mind. And as long as they're not dormant, which spiritual practices produce dormancy in these old impressions, but if they're not dormant, they will raise their heads. So what do you do then? What do you do then, Jim?
Good question. Consider the vasanas and where they come from.
Mm-hmm.
And it just depends.
Mm-hmm. And you bet. It sometimes just depends, doesn't
sometimes
it?
Sometimes you go along with the vasanas.
Yeah. Sometimes you shake your fist. You know?
Well, this is could be good too.
This is the thing. Peaceful. This is this wonderful story of the brahmachari and the cobra. This cobra had been terrorizing a village, particularly the young people of the village that came out to play in the field where it had its hole. One time a brahmachari came along and the cobra came out to terrorize the brahmachari, and of course the brahmachari wasn't frightened. And the snake recognized the holy man and said, "Oh, holy man, you have no fear, please teach me." And so the holy man said, "Well, the first imperative is harmlessness. You must learn to practice harmlessness." And he went on his way. And the cobra, taking him very seriously, stopped terrorizing these young people, became very submissive. And of course, they soon learned that he wasn't going to threaten to bite them anymore. So they began to beat on him and reduce him to just a shell of himself. He had to live on grass and... You know, so in a period of time, the brahmachari came back and the cobra came out of his hole and saw the brahmachari and bowed to him respectfully. And the brahmachari said, "What in the world happened to you? What happened to you?" He said, "Well, you know, I followed your directive and I stopped being harmful. And so the boys of the village began to beat me up and break my bones and so on. And so I'm reduced to this." And the brahmachari said, "Fool, oh, you great fool, I told you not to bite. I didn't tell you not to hiss. I didn't tell you not to hiss. We have to hiss sometimes. We have to let people know that there's something here not to be trampled on. And this is control of ourselves, not biting, not being harmful, but letting people know, no, 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 I'm not your doormat. You can't just kick me down the stairs." Very tricky in the moment. But these vasanas of being retaliatory, harmful, they need to be controlled if we're going to have a calm mind. And notice that this keeps coming up. The calmness of the mind, of course, what this means is a calm body as well as a calm mind. The mind and the body are not two separate things. The mind actually is throughout your body. The citta, the mind stuff, is throughout your whole body. So when you're practicing compassion and kindness and not allowing your old vasanas to govern your behavior, your whole body becomes more peaceful, which is why you can sit quietly and do your manana and do your nididhyasana if you're a jnani. If you're constantly agitated and constantly, your body is constantly in motion, because of the agitation. Hopeless condition. You're not going to be able to sit quietly and consider, as you said, Jim, consistency. Every day at this time, I sit and I read and I get calm and I reflect on these things. That has a lasting day-through effect. Anybody else? Yes, Swayam.
First of all, I try to stay away from news, or I'm very careful on where I go, realizing that nowadays there's a lot of bias in news, and you can't always, I guess, be very trustful in what you hear and see.
Mm-hmm.
And when there is some bad news, I also try to remember the good things that are being done that we don't hear about, the yum, yum, yum person. Mm-hmm. Or try to go and look for some a good component to balance out the negative that comes at me. And then I try to remember your words, mm-hmm. that if I can do something, I do. If not, I pray to Mother and pray for, you know, them that she handles.
Well.
And as far as traffic is concerned, I let my husband drive and I sit in the passenger seat and enjoy Nirvana.
That's a good one.
As long as Naveen is okay with that, but we're fine.
And then others also take it on another back seat, the back, you take the passenger, I take the back seat.
Swayam mentioned the yum 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 person. She was gesturing toward a wonderful man named Wavy Gravy. That's the name that he's been given. He goes way back to the 60s. He continues to live and serve in Berkeley, California. He feeds people virtually every day, homeless people and other people. But he also is part of a foundation called the Seva Foundation that helps repair people's vision in Nepal and elsewhere. And it does a tremendous amount. Thousands of people regain full or partial vision because of the administrations of the Seva Foundation, which goes to this lady's comment. I'm sorry, dear, I don't know your name. We may have been introduced, but I don't see well enough to recognize you at this distance. So the idea being that we do what we can, and some of us have a longer reach than others. You know, Wavy Gravy was at Woodstock. Many of you know the story of Woodstock. These many, many, many thousands of young people came together for this celebration of music, and it rained like the dickens and turned the whole place into a mud field. And so the people who were supposed to feed these folks couldn't get in, couldn't do their work. And Wavy Gravy is just of the nature. He somehow found a way to phone and get the military to come and drop food for those people. They came in helicopters and dropped food for those people. Now, that was Wavy Gravy on the phone doing this. And we know the truth of it, not only because one of our congregation, Jerry Brunner, was at Woodstock and saw this happen, but the mechanic who works on the center's car, John Mullen, was one of the people in one of those helicopters dropping the food. He lives very close by over on Fellowship Road. So, you know, it just depends on what we're capable of doing. You know, Wavy Gravy's capable of much just by his nature. Some of us don't have that nature. You can go online, by the way, and just type in Wavy Gravy song. And he's got the one on YouTube right now. It's just really something to listen to. But we do what we can. We do what we can. Thank you, Swayam. Thank you for mentioning Wavy Gravy. Anybody else? Well, it's 12:10. I have something else provocative to read. And it's very important for those of us who think about non-dualism, but don't really practice it. Swami Yatishwarananda was the teacher for the man who founded this place. Swami Yogeshananda's guru was Swami Yatishwarananda. Swami Yatishwarananda was at that time in Philadelphia. He went on to go back to India and eventually became a vice president of the Ramakrishna Order, very prestigious, very, and he simply left the body before they could make him president, Maharaj. But in any case, here's something from Swami Yatishwarananda about the practice of Advaita. Many people want to practice non-dualistic meditation, very often after reading a few books on Advaita. So many people talk about the absolute. But what do they attain on the practical side? Most of them give up after a short while. They find they're getting nowhere. In the case of a few others, it may take them several months or even years of futile effort to understand that non-dualism is beyond their grasp. People forget that non-dualism is a state of actual experience. It is not what appeals to you intellectually that is important, but what actually you can do. We should not attempt anything simply by reading books. A dualist with real spiritual experience is infinitely better than a monist without experience. So long as there is meditation and the object of meditation, even in the subtlest form, it is dualism. So this is something for us to grasp. Even the monist, even the Advaitin, while they're still practicing, while they're still ridding themselves of all the baggage that is holding them back, holding them down, is practicing as a dualist. The reading, the thinking, the meditation, as long as there is an object of meditation, it is dualism. And so we shouldn't get ourselves too jumped up about this, about being an Advaitin, until we have actually experienced the samadhi of Advaita. And then, of course, there's no possibility of getting jumped up, because the humility that comes with the understanding of the truth, and then the very clear vision of what it is that brought them to that place, is a cause not for pride, but just for joy, in the presence of those who have been realized, who have had that realization experience. There's never any pride. There's never any sense of, boy, howdy, I'm something. No. As Sri Ramakrishna said, I am the dust of the devotee's feet. So this is Swami Yatishwarananda very wisely putting both jnana yoga and bhakti yoga, and for that matter karma yoga, in perspective. So anything to say in response to those very strong words, very wise words?
Keep doing.
Yes, exactly. Just keep on keeping on. Keep putting one foot in front of the other, with the understanding that the more regular I am about it, the more I do it every day, the more successful I will become. Why? There's no magic or mystery about it. As Vivekananda said, education is nothing more than the manifestation of the perfection already within you. And, corollary, education is nothing more than the training of the nerves. If you're going to train your nerves, you're not going to do it very well if you just do it once a week. If you do it every morning, much better. If you do it every morning and every evening, better still. And it's so slowly and slowly, what happens is your life is transformed just by the effort itself. As Nisargadatta Maharaj said to a questioner who said, well, Maharaj, you have this way of being and in the world, this way of seeing the world, and I have this other way. Why can't I be like you are? Why is the world so real to me when it seems to you as if it's a dream? And Nisargadatta said, very simply, the world is so real for you because you think about it so much. If we wish the world to be unreal for us, or to take its proper place in the scale of reality, a spectrum of reality, then we stop thinking about it so much and think more about the truths that are embodied by someone like Nisargadatta or Ramana Maharshi or Swami Vivekananda or Sri Ramakrishna or Holy Mother or Saint Teresa of Avila. You know, it's not a male prerogative. Mirabai, Maitreya. Anything else from anyone? All right. We'll close with our usual beautiful prayer for peace. Again, a translation of this ancient prayer by Swami Yogeshananda. Let there be peace in outer space. Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters. Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees. May the gods be peaceful. May the whole universe be pervaded by peace. Let this infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Om Peace, Peace. Peace be unto us and to all beings everywhere. Jai, 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 Sri Ramakrishna, Jai Ma. So, I think if we go inside, whether it's all been nicely arranged yet or not, I don't know, but we'll find that there is the usual nice spread of things for us to eat and enjoy one another's company, and there'll be tea and coffee and so on. So thank you for coming, and thank you all for participating in this. This is what's meant by an open forum. We learn together. We do our manana together. As it says, may we have the strength and skill to study together the art of spirituality. This isn't Vedanta for you. This is Vedanta with you. So thank you.